ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast includes references to suicide and sexual assault and uses the name and voice of an Aboriginal person who's died.
G'day, folks. My name is Erin Park and my voice might be a little bit familiar because I've done a bit of reporting for Background Briefing over the years. But I'm really excited today that I'm not the one telling the story. I'm with reporter Kirsty Wallauer, who has a fascinating investigation that she's been working on, and she's going to be telling me all about it. Good morning, Kirsty. Can you hear me okay?
Hi, Erin. Yep, I can hear you great.
Now, all I know is that this is a three-part series, and it's called Tammy's Story. What's it basically about, and where are we going to start this story?
So this story starts outside a blue weatherboard house. It's got a gable roof and it's on a very quiet street in southwest Sydney. I'm here to meet a woman named Vicky Shipley. It was her mother's house and now she lives here with her granddaughter.
Hi, Kirsty, come in.
Vicky has three kids and a bunch of grandkids and a couple of great-grandkids.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Not too bad.
Not too bad.
Within these walls are decades of family memories, and heaps of grandchildren and kids have lived here at different times.
Where do you want to sit?
Just at the table?
Yeah. You want a cup of tea or coffee?
I'm all good, thank you.
Water?
Yes, we sit down at this really large square dining room table. There's kids' toys and little knickknacks all over the place. Behind me is this buffet hatch. And it's packed with all of these pictures of kids and the grandkids. Amongst all this, one of the photos jumps out to me. It's a large portrait photo of a woman in her 40s.
That picture.
She's got long blonde hair, blue eyes, and she's smiling.
It showed how happy, how loving. Her eyes were just so loving and happy to live life.
This is Vicky's daughter, Tammy. She's the reason I've come to talk to Vicky today. Tammy spent a lot of time in this house, and as I'm listening to Vicky, I'm starting to picture her in these walls. Growing up, she was into netball.
She loved sport, and she was an excellent sprinter.
Smashed it at school.
She's very academic. She was quite bright and very successful.
She took pride in her Aboriginal heritage and loved poetry.
She would always be making up different sorts of poems.
But Vicky also tells me that Tammy faced some struggles in her life. She says in high school, Tammy was sexually assaulted by a teacher. Her mental health deteriorated. She fell into drug addiction. She stopped playing those sports that she loved. She stopped writing those poems that she loved.
That's obviously very tough for any family to deal with, isn't it? Seeing that play out.
It was really tough. But Vicky says that Tammy just got on with her life. And as Tammy got older, she did a hairdressing apprenticeship, a beautician course, and she had six kids.
She was a great mum. With her children, she was like another child. If they wanted to cook brownies late at night, she would cook it with them. You know, she would play craft. She would get up and do TikToks with them. They played in the backyard. She took them swimming to water parks. Whatever she could afford, the children came first.
Bye, darling. I love you.
But Tammy's not here today. Because one night, 3.5 years ago, things changed forever. It's 9 p.m. at night, and Vicky has just gotten home from work. Some of her grandkids are hanging out upstairs. It's just before Christmas, so there's some decorations around the home. A Christmas tree, lights, some little knickknacks. But there's a solemn feeling in the air. And then two unexpected people arrive at Vicky's house. It's the police.
I was just finishing cleaning up and my nephew, he had taken the bins out for the night when the police pulled up and they asked him whether they were at the right address.
They asked to come inside and talk to her, but Vicky isn't very fond of the police. She's had negative run-ins with them in the past, so instead she goes outside to hear what they have to say.
I got told outside that my daughter was dead. And I asked why. And they said that she had drunk a lot of water.
She'd drunk a lot of water and that's how she died.
Yep. Vicky barely has a moment to process this before she goes back inside where Tammy's kids are waiting and she tells them what happened.
I was so angry. And disbelief, just total disbelief that this had happened. Somewhere where they're supposed to look after and protect people.
What a terrible piece of news to get at Christmas time for that family. Where was Tammy when she died?
She was being held in Sydney's Silverwater Correctional Centre.
So she actually died when she was in prison?
She did. Tammy was in custody in a cell with 24-hour surveillance. She died from drinking too much water in a place you'd expect her to be watched very closely. And no one noticed. Tammy arrives at Silverwater Correctional Centre at 8:30 on a Sunday morning. There's high fencing all around with barbed wire at the top, surveillance cameras on tall light poles everywhere you look. And from above, you'd see a cluster of geometric white-roofed buildings, roads and open courtyards. So it's not just a single prison, it's a complex. And inside...
The cells are very bare, the pods are... large concrete blocks, there's just nothing really there. Everything's concrete, everything's hard, everything's dull.
One of the first things Tammy does at Silverwater is sit down for an intake screening with a nurse. Someone like Jade Coupland. She's a registered nurse and she's worked in a lot of these prisons, including Silverwater, but on the men's side.
That nurse will take down everything. Any mental health medication, physical health, drug and alcohol concerns, anything that we need to know to keep them healthy while they're in there.
And if they have important medications...
We'll get them arranged, we'll administer them. And if they need urgent care, we will contact, if we have an on-site doctor or an on-call doctor.
So Tammy's sitting down for one of these intake screenings and the nurses say she's appearing teary. She's not making eye contact with a nurse and she's telling her that she's depressed and thinking of harming herself. And so a senior correctional officer decides to put her in a safe cell because that's where she can be constantly checked and they also say she should get human interaction.
Okay, so it sounds like they're trying to do the right thing there with making notes and making a plan to make sure she stays safe.
Yeah, they are. And Jade says it's not unusual that a lot of these prisoners that they see have some kind of mental illness.
Severity ranges, of course, but yeah, I would say it would be a rare occasion I wouldn't have a patient with a mental condition.
After Tammy finishes her screening, she's moved into a holding cell. There she starts acting strangely. We know this because it's captured on CCTV. Tammy's wandering around semi-naked. And then she starts doing something else. She goes to the water bubbler in her cell. She leans over and drinks for 17 seconds. She stops. Then she drinks for another 19 seconds. and then she stops and goes back again, drinking for 26 seconds.
26 seconds, that's an unusually long amount of time to be guzzling water, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. It is really strange. And actually, these are the first signs of behaviour that will cause Tammy's body to shut down just 9 days later. Soon, Tammy has moved out of the holding cell and into a safe cell. There's no CCTV, but the guards are regularly checking on her. And then while she's there, she tries to harm herself twice in the space of just half an hour.
At that point, she should have been sent to a hospital. At that point, anyone in the community that attempts a suicide gets taken to a hospital. Why aren't they?
Prisoners in Silverwater who self-harm can be taken to mental health wards inside prison. But on that day, there are no mental health beds available, so staff have to put her somewhere else. They need a cell that has a way to observe her, and usually that is with CCTV, where she can be kept under constant observation. The only cells available at that time are in a unit called the Mum Shell Unit.
Okay, so is that where there'd be people that are trained to look after her properly?
Not really. Most of the guards there are not trained to deal with acute and vulnerable mental health patients.
Okay. So what happens to Tammy when she's put into this unit?
When Tammy arrives in that centre, it's really bleak. She's placed on her own in cell number 5. It's plain, it's got white walls with a single bed and purple plastic sheets, a shower with no curtain, and there's a toilet and sink combination next to it. The next morning, Tammy's not in a good way. She's talking to herself and she's pacing back and forth to the tap, drinking. And from here, things really start to unravel. Around lunchtime, she's visited by a nurse and 2 guards. That's what's known as a RIT team, and their job is to manage inmates at risk of self-harm. But when they arrive, the guards from the Mum Shell unit tell them Tammy's been confused and aggressive. It's not clear what they're basing this assessment on, but the bottom line is the RIT team doesn't enter the cell. And that means the RIT team can only talk to Tammy by opening the hatch in the door and speaking through it. It's also hard for them to see Tammy. The door has a window, but the blinds on the window are broken, so they can't see through it unless they put their head up close and peer through the gap. Instead, they look through the hatch and they see Tammy is naked. She doesn't make eye contact with them. There's fecal matter on the floor and they ask Tammy to put her clothes on, but she doesn't. So they move on and leave her alone.
And what medical care and attention is she getting at this point?
Well, they've made a plan that Tammy is to be monitored constantly by the CCTV and checked by the guards every 30 to 60 minutes. They also put her on a wait list to see a psychiatrist in the urgent category, meaning she's supposed to see one within 1 to 3 days. But that doesn't happen.
So you've described this really grim scene where Tammy's in a cell with fecal matter on the floor. Only interaction is through a little metal flap in the door. How does that play out? What happens from there?
So while she's in this state, her family on the outside are really desperate to get through to her. But Tammy's asked not to call anyone.
That's what happens when she's mentally ill.
So they keep calling.
We all rang. And then they would hang up on you. And so we'd try again and again.
The family worries because Tammy has schizophrenia.
Oh, okay.
And the prison knows this too.
We're trying to tell them the medication that she was on.
But they still can't get through.
And each time they just passed us from person to person until they hung up on us.
On her 5th day in custody, Tammy's allowed to go and meet that RIT team face-to-face in the common area in the Mum Shell unit. She tells them she has a psychosis and thought that someone had a hit out on her.
Sorry, had a hit out on her?
Yeah, so that's part of her hallucinations, those kind of delusions that she has, that she thinks that someone in the community has had a hit out on her, that someone was trying to harm her, to kill her, and that's a symptom of her schizophrenia.
Okay.
So she's told the nurses this, and she's telling them that she is feeling better and that she really wants to go home and she wants to take care of her newborn granddaughter.
Okay, that sounds promising.
Yeah, but she hasn't seen a psychiatrist or a doctor. And as the prison staff are trying to chase her medical records, she starts getting worse. It's the 18th of December, Tammy's ninth day in custody. She's waking up from her sleep, she's getting up out of bed, she's leaning over the sink, and she's drinking from the tap directly. She's got this red cup and also a milk carton. And throughout the day, she's filling them up and drinking out of both. At one stage, she presses a button in her cell.
Has breakfast come yet?
No.
These are real recordings from inside the prison. Tammy's making what's known as a knock-up call, speaking to nurses and guards from her cell.
Medical.
Yeah, I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
Okay, we'll consult that out.
Vicky says none of the family got a call. The next day, Tammy continues to fill up her red cup. She asks to hear some music.
Medical.
Is it possible to put music on?
Music on? Yeah, well, I'll do it, all right?
Thank you.
I can imagine requesting music because the silence is horrible. Like, I feel like even I could imagine that. Just sometimes you want some background noise to break the boredom and the silence of where you find yourself.
We do know that she spent a lot of that afternoon crying in her cell. She wasn't happy. She was, you know, there wasn't much to do.
No, someone crying for hours does not sound like a good situation. What does happen next, Kirsty?
It's 5 days before Christmas, Tammy's final day in prison. She hasn't had a great sleep and she's been drinking the water from that red cup from the early hours. We've seen CCTV footage from Tammy's last day. It's a view from the bottom left corner of Tammy's cell. Tammy's sitting on the corner of her bed. She's holding her red cup and she's raising it and drinking out of it. And just a heads up, it gets pretty confronting from here. But we think it's really important to include because it shows how sick Tammy was. It's soon after 10 a.m. and Tammy has thrown up. Still, she's refilling her red cup and she's forcing herself to drink and keep drinking, even though she throws up again. She's sitting on the toilet, breathing really deeply, and she looks like she's in a sort of discomfort. At one point, she kneels over the bowl and empties her bowels onto the floor.
Oh, that's awful. And is this all being watched and monitored by prison staff?
Yeah, it is. And around this time, an officer comes to the door to serve her a meal. He's looking through the hatch and he finds Tammy in that condition, in that discomfort. He's standing outside the door with another guard. They put her food on the hatch and they give her a hot drink and then they leave. The officer says that he moved on because he wanted to give her privacy and that he didn't notice that there was feces on the floor and didn't know that she'd vomited. Tammy's now in the grip of a medical emergency. She's consumed about 20 litres of water in this day alone.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's really serious now. At this point, it's not too late to save Tammy's life, but someone needs to notice and someone needs to intervene. Just before midday, 75 minutes after that check, Tammy collapses on her bed and starts twitching. Her body goes into spasms. Then right as Tammy is having that seizure, just as her hand spasms and the red cup falls to the floor, three guards walk past her cell.
Do they look in?
They don't. And without making the effort to check, they can't see into the room because the broken blind is covering the window.
Oh, gosh.
It's been more than 90 minutes since they last checked on her. Tammy's still seizing. She tries to reach for the duress alarm, but misses. Another 7 minutes go by. A guard walks past cell 5 again, but doesn't look in.
Oh.
15 minutes later, Tammy slouches between the bed and the ground. The guard walks past her for a third time, and they don't look in.
But isn't by this point Tammy supposed to be being checked on every 30 minutes?
That's right. But by the time an officer glances at the CCTV monitors and sees Tammy lying face down on the floor, 2.5 hours have passed since anyone went to physically check on her.
Mm.
Experts will later say that by this point, it's already too late to save Tammy.
That's tragic.
And it still takes another 23 minutes for anyone to start CPR.
23 minutes between when they spot her collapsed and when they start CPR. What reason could there be for that, do you think?
So what we know is just as Tammy was spotted on that CCTV screen, lying on the floor, a trainee psychiatrist arrives at the unit to see her. This is the person she's been waiting 8 days to see.
Oh, okay.
So he and two guards head to Tammy's cell and they try to speak to her through the hatch. They don't open the door and they don't go in and check on her. They decide to ask a nurse instead. They don't flag it as an emergency. It takes another 10 minutes before that nurse finishes her medication rounds, puts on PPE because there's been a COVID outbreak in the unit, and goes to Tammy's cell. She's been on the floor, she's been seizing, she's been convulsing, and it's now been around an hour and a half since Tammy first collapsed.
Okay.
It's been nearly 3 hours since anyone physically checked on her. And now finally, someone enters her cell and begins CPR.
Ambulance emergency, what town or suburb?
Stillwater Women's Correctional Centre. I've got a woman unconscious. They've just put the defib on her. She's not responding.
Okay.
They're performing CPR.
All right.
If we can do this really quickly.
Yep, I'll try and get it as quickly as I can.
I'm watching them now. They're going.
Okay.
The ambulance arrives and paramedics take over. But it's too late. And at 2:25 p.m, they stop CPR.
They came at 9 o'clock at night to tell me she was dead. And she'd been dead since 2 o'clock.
And that's dead from drinking too much water.
Yeah, she died from drinking too much water. Because Tammy was in custody when she died, how she died is investigated by the New South Wales coroner. It's how I've been able to describe so much of what happened. Because the coroner and Tammy's family agreed we could use most of the evidence they gathered. The inquest tries to get to the bottom of why she was left unchecked for so long, seizing on the bed while guards repeatedly walk past her. One by one, the prison staff give their evidence. They say they were understaffed, that they didn't realise how serious Tammy's condition was, that the broken blind made it hard to see what was happening. It turns out there'd been a request to fix the blind 23 days before Tammy died, but it didn't happen because the job was ranked as a low priority. Among the staff who give evidence is Jacob Wilson, the last guard to perform a physical check on Tammy before she died. He walks up and sits in the witness box. The coroner sits off to his left. In front of him at the bar table are the lawyers. And off to the right in the public gallery sits some of Tammy's family. Lawyer assisting the coroner, Peggy Dwyer SC, stands as she questions him. We've had actors recreate one of their exchanges.
You know that Tammy was supposed to be on observations every half hour. And that in fact nobody, no correctional officer, physically appears to have observed her between the last one that you did at 10:41 and 1:14 p.m. That's a terrible failing from corrective services, isn't it?
Yes, I wasn't aware that none of us had done one, but yes.
Were you assuming that one of your other officers would be doing one after 10:41?
I believe I was just very busy, lost track of time, and just wasn't aware that no one else had had any interaction.
It was a collective responsibility for the four officers on duty for that wing, wasn't it?
Yes.
Do you think that that is part of the problem? That no one individual was given the task of doing the observations?
Yes.
And that's why it fell through the cracks and Tammy wasn't observed for that 2.5 hours?
Yes.
And that's why it fell through the cracks. The inquest also hears that corrective services did their own investigation and found four guards in the Mumshell unit failed in their duty of care to Tammy and failed to follow prison policies. On the final day of the inquest, the lawyer representing Tammy's family, Stephen Rees, sums up their position.
Tammy was powerless in the Mumshell unit. She was mentally ill. She couldn't help herself. She relied on Corrective Services New South Wales to keep her safe. That was their duty. They failed in that duty.
I put detailed questions to Corrective Services New South Wales and Justice Health, which provides healthcare in prisons. With the coroner's findings yet to be handed down, both declined to answer them, but extended their sympathies to Tammy's family. A spokesperson for Corrective Services also said they'd implement changes recommended by the coroner where appropriate. During the inquest, the coroner deals with one more really important question. Why was Tammy drinking so much water in the first place? It turns out she developed a condition called psychogenic polydipsia.
Psychogenic polydipsia.
That's right.
Okay, and what is that?
It's a rare complication that can be often associated with psychotic illnesses. And Dr. Olav Nielsen, a forensic psychiatrist that gave evidence at Tammy's inquest, he says in Tammy's case,
it does seem to be linked to schizophrenia.
And it gave her the urge to constantly drink water. And when you drink as much water as Tammy did,
you dilute your electrolytes, particularly your sodium. The drop in sodium affects neurological function and also your osmotic state of your brain, and you can have seizures and die.
That's what he says happened to Tammy.
In her case, the very acute nature of it, she just drank and drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of water, which is quite a dangerously large amount of pure water.
Olav has reviewed Tammy's medical records, and he says they show there's no evidence she ever suffered polydipsia before she was sent to Silverwater Corrections Centre. He thinks it was the time Tammy spent isolated in her cell that brought this on.
If she'd been communicating with people out and about, she may not have just kept going back and forth to the tap. But I think the sensory deprivation is a kind of torture, and my guess is that it probably had something to do with it.
What this means is, if Tammy hadn't been in prison, it's possible she wouldn't have started drinking so much water. And that makes the question of how she ended up in prison very important. Because Tammy wasn't taken to prison against her will. Tammy asked to go to prison. And she asked to go there because she thought it would be the only place that she'd be safe.
I went to Woolworths to get charged.
Okay.
So I could come here and be safe.
You came to say she wanted to be mocked up.
Yep.
I don't think she should have been in there in the first place.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, that should mean you'll be released.
That's next time on Tammy's Story. If this story has raised issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can also call Crisis Support Service 13 Yarn on 13 92 76. This series is a collaboration with the ABC's Indigenous Affairs team. Background Briefing sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner, sound engineering by Isabella Trapiano. Music composition by Russell Stapleton and fact-checking by Justine Landis-Hanley. Our rollout producer is Ben Svein. The producer for this story was Joanna McCarthy. The supervising producer is Max Chalmers and the executive producer is Fanu Falali. The reporter on this story is Kirsty Willauer. And I'm Erin Park. To hear more episodes, search for the Background Briefing podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.